Good morning. Good morning. Make sure you're awake. It's a real honor to be able to introduce our speaker this day and for this week. Dr. Gary Collins has traveled from his home in Chicago, Illinois to be with us. And Gary is the past president of the American Association of Christian Counselors. He's the editor of Christian Counseling Today. He's written many dozens, I suppose, outstanding books that have been translated into many, many languages. Gary is certainly known by those in the know as one of the founding fathers of contemporary Christian counseling. But more than all of his impressive credentials and accolades, to me, is who Gary is. Gary is a man of compassion and humility. He's the person that I turn to for all kinds of inspiration. How do I know him? Because he's a friend. I've had the opportunity to be with Gary in many different situations. I suppose we've crisscrossed the country and been on the same platforms countless times. We've had a chance to travel overseas more than once together, Jakarta, Manila, Singapore, Hong Kong. And when you're with somebody like that long enough, you get to know who they really are. It's difficult to hide your character in those circumstances, and I know Gary. And he is what we sometimes say flippantly, he's the real deal. As I said, I turn to Gary when I struggle spiritually. He's become a mentor. He has a way of keeping me on the straight and narrow, gently, as we say, without guilt. And he's also a man that, he just is an example of a life well lived. I have so many examples I don't want to take up his time with, but he's truly an inspiration. I hope you'll help me join in welcoming him with a good SPU welcome. Would you do that for Dr. Gary Collins?
He gets to know me pretty well. I get to know him pretty well, especially when we have chances to travel. We went on a trip, I think, for almost 3 weeks one time, and you get to know each other pretty well on those kinds of occasions, and it was a lot of fun. It's good to be back on the SPU campus. I haven't been here for a while. I grew up in Canada and came out to the Pacific Northwest a number of years ago and took some internship in psychology, studied some theology, and met my future wife, who is a graduate of this place. And so I've learned a lot about, this was back when it was called Seattle Pacific College, and I thought this is wonderful. I like this area. It's a marvelous place, and I'm sure we'll stay here for the rest of our lives. And after I got my degree, we went back to St. Paul, Minnesota, where we've been in the Midwest ever since. I was sitting next to a guy on the plane yesterday, and he was from Melbourne, Australia, and he said, "Where do you live?" And I said, "In Chicago." And he said, "Why would you ever want to live in Chicago?" I said, "That's a good question. You Aussies ask some really good questions. But I like it here because the weather is nice most of the time, I guess. The scenery is spectacular. The coffee is world-renowned. We know all that. And the population includes not only a bunch of great people, but also some weird people, I'm told. Because around the country, when you start thinking about what's happening in some of the New Age-ish type of stuff, a lot of the centers for new spirituality, some of the New Age trends, New Age dress, New Age body-piercing stuff, and all that sort of thing, and new spiritualities, a lot of the center for that sort of stuff is in the Pacific Northwest, including here in Seattle. Now, I don't get a chance very much to read the Seattle newspaper. In fact, I had one slid under my door this morning and haven't seen one for a long time, but I read the Chicago paper. And on New Year's Day this year, there was an article in the Chicago paper, and it was describing what this year is likely to be like, 1999. And this article is talking about, it says, final years of the past centuries are any guide, 1999 will be a real doozy. It might even include the end of the world. And it goes on to describe what has happened historically throughout the world when you come to a new century. And of course, now we're coming to a new millennium. Year 999, there was a guy who was an emperor of Germany, I guess, and he decided to give up his emperorship, or whatever he was called, and went out into the desert because he said, once we come to the end of the year, then the world's going to end, and I'm just going to wait for God to come back and take me up to heaven. And it didn't quite happen. The year 1399, there was people all over Europe, apparently, were dressing in white robes and in bare feet, middle of winter, wandering all over Europe, going to different kinds of cathedrals because they wanted to be purged of their sins to be ready when the world ended at the coming of the year 1400. then, many years later, 1799, John Adams got up and gave a speech in the Congress, and he said he was very worried about the state of the Republic at this time of history. I've heard some of that lately. Many years later, there was a guy named Sir Isaac Newton. You know about him. He made a prediction. He said that in the year 1999, right now, this would be the last year of the world. So you better cram a lot of stuff in. Because he said, by the end of this year, beginning of the year 2000, the world would end. Well, there's a guy who's written a book about this, on end time prophecies. He's a scholarly guy, and he's an evangelical who was in a cult for a while, and he wrote this big fat book, and he says in this book that there is so much interest now in what's going to happen at the end of this century that they developed a whole new department of studies, a whole new thing called Millennium Studies. And apparently, these people pull together books and papers and scholarly conferences and all kinds of stuffy meetings to talk about weird people out there with all of these end-time prophecies. Boston University has even established a Center for Millennium Studies just to serve as a clearinghouse for all this stuff that's taking place. So we see a lot of people out there who are apparently kind of nervous what's going to happen at the end of this year. Now, we see this in the church, we see it in the media, of course, we see it in centers of computer science. Christianity Today magazine has a cover story, the current issue, on the panic over Y2K. See, we have a technological now worry about the end of the century. And APA Monitor, which is a publication of the American Psychological Association, in the current issue, says that centers where people go for to talk about anxiety and anxiety disorders, those centers have begun to see an increase in people coming in because people who are uncertain about the future are really getting worried. And, you know, I'm not a computer expert. I'm told I'm computer savvy for somebody my age. I don't know what that means. So I don't know why I'm supposed to get nervous about this or not. And I've got people whom I respect on both sides of the issue, but a lot of people are really concerned about what's going to happen when we get to the end of this year and the computers don't roll over and all that stuff. So I suspect if you're a psychologist or an anthropologist or a sociologist, you're in religion or even computer science or almost any field, this kind of stuff should be right up your alley because there's a lot of people are fascinated with what's going on right now and what might happen at the end of this year. Now, all this talk about New Age spiritualities and end-time prophecies and doomsday cults, hear about the cult, you know, a couple of weeks ago, they brought back from Jerusalem those people from Denver who'd gone over there, and they were going to blow up portions of Jerusalem at the end of this year because that would make a haste in the second coming of Christ. And they brought them back here now. I don't know if they're going to blow things up here or not. I don't know yet. But all this stuff, how does this introduce what's supposed to be called the Wesley Lectures? And then when I got the letter, I thought, why are they asking me to give the Wesley Lectures? I'm a psychologist. And I don't know that much about Wesley. I know something about Wesley. I know he had a phenomenal mother whose name was Susanna. I read a big fat book about her a couple years ago. I know he had an absentee father who apparently came home periodically because they had a zillion kids. And he'd come back and get her pregnant and take off again. I know that. I know he had a brother named Charles who wrote a lot of hymns that were kind of slow, 5,000 of them. But they were very contemporary at the time. Probably like the kinds of stuff we were having this morning. And I know that John Wesley was a scholar, that he was a short-term missionary, that he was an evangelist, that he did a lot of horseback riding and all that sort of stuff. I also know that he was interested in contemporary spirituality. And if he was living around here now, he probably would be very interested in the kinds of things we're seeing in the new spiritualities, the new age-based stuff, and the end of the decade panic that some people are expressing. So when I talk about give these Wesley lectures today in the next couple of days, I really want to sort of speak in the spirit of Wesley's attitude of understanding what's going on in our culture and thinking about how do we reach this culture when these interesting things are going on. Today I'd like to talk about some of the contemporary spiritualities that are out there. And tomorrow talk about some of the present spiritualities. How does it apply to you and me living in this age? And then on the third day, talk about some of the outreach stuff. I get very excited about what's happening in the whole area of spirituality right now because I think it has tremendous potential for us to impact the world around us. Well, I don't know if you've done this recently, but sometimes go into a secular bookstore. If you're too tired, you know, log on to Amazon.com and see what's going on in the spirituality area. You will find some really interesting stuff there. I like to wander around in bookstores and get lost in there sometimes. But you go to the spirituality section, And you'll find books that we'll talk about. I made a list off the top of my head. Books on the millennium, books on the soul, on spirit journeys, on UFOs, on aliens, on shamanism. A lot of shamans apparently in this area. I know a guy in Illinois, he's a psychiatrist, comes out every year to meet with his shaman in Seattle someplace. I know that's not typical of the city. But there's a lot of interest in shamanism, a lot of interest in prayer, all kinds of prayer, the kind of prayer we're concerned about, but some really unusual kind of prayer. There's stuff on faith healing and spirit possession, Native American spirituality and feminist spirituality and masculine spirituality and demons and witchcraft and energy psychology and mind control and herbal cures and a whole bunch of other stuff. And if you look into these books, they have some similar themes come up again and again. For example, you'll see this theme that says much of spirituality today is concerned about finding spiritual enlightenment, finding growth. And it says to do that, you've got to turn off your mind. Be guided by intuition, a lot of these books say. Let your mind drift into emptiness. Forget all this rational stuff that you find in a place like this. Don't be constrained by rational, logical thinking. And that's the essence of much of contemporary spirituality. I did a book on this came out last year, so I spent a year trying to read a lot of this stuff and research it and get the feeling of what's going on in this area. Secondly, a lot of these books will say not only are they talking about spiritual enlightenment that comes more from intuition, but they're also saying or assuming that the materialism, the hedonism, the career building that some of us are concerned with, that just produces a bunch of emptiness. What we really want is enlightenment, and the way to get enlightenment is not to stand up in front of a bunch of people and clap your hands and say, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." No, you look within yourself, because that's where you're going to find the enlightenment. And you find some kind of an inner angel, or a spirit guide, or some kind of a guru healer who will help you to find enlightenment on the inside. And a lot of people are looking for spirituality on that way. Another thing you find in a lot of these books is an emphasis on energy forces. How can we kind of align the forces? Ever read the Celestine Prophecy or the other book, James Redmond wrote, where he talks about some lady or some guy walking along and stumbles and sprains an ankle, and the ankle swells up, and they try to deal with it with the traditional Western medicine. You know, they put an ACE bandage around and all that stuff. Doesn't work. So somebody comes along and says, no, the problem is wrong. The forces are out of alignment. So what we need to really do is sit here and concentrate on that particular point on your ankle. And if we can get all these forces in alignment again, then the swelling will go down. Do it that way instead of old-fashioned Western medicine. Because the emphasis is how we can somehow pull all these forces together. And if you can align up the forces, then you're going to gain energy, you're going to eliminate repressed memories, you're going to restore energy balance, you're going to sharpen your psychic powers, and you're going to replace your sadness with joy. And many of these books, in addition, say, we've got to emphasize tolerance. It's okay if you SPU students want to come together and sing like you do this morning. That's okay. If that works with you, it's okay. This happened to me when I was in graduate school. I had a professor one time, and she'd been watching me, I guess, for a while, and she said, "You know, I can't understand you, Gary. You seem to believe differently than most of these psychology students at Purdue University. What do you believe in?" So I told her. She said, "Boy, I wish I could believe like that." She was very tolerant, open to let me believe what I wanted to believe, but that's okay, as long as I didn't interrupt what she was believing. And so there's a tolerance that no object, no absolutes, no truth, there is no such truth. When I spent time researching this book that I wrote, spending time talking to people and trying to understand, I found that a lot of people today have kind of a buffet style of Christianity, you know, like a cafeteria style. You pick up a little bit here, or spirituality, you pick up a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here. And everybody comes away from the spirituality plate with the buffet with things that are different on their plate. And you try things, and then you can go back for more and take a little more. And that's the way spirituality has evolved. And so people pick up their own gods, their own morals, their own standards of worship. As I researched this book, I also found out that a lot of people are, in addition, confused. A lot of people around us, I think, don't have any anchors in life. A lot of people don't know, they know there's something more to life than what they've got, but they don't know what it is. And they're looking for something new. But one thing they're all convinced of, that is that the spirituality of John Wesley and John Calvin, if I can mention him here, and contemporary American Christianity, they say that spirituality was okay for them and for some people, but it doesn't apply to those of us who live in 1999, maybe facing crisis coming up, maybe having a Y2K crisis, or worse, the world ending. That stuff's not going to work. I had dinner one time with a guy in Denver. This was about 3 or 4 years ago, and I asked him one day, tell me what church you go to. He said, oh, I don't go to church. He said, I'm a recovering Catholic. I thought, well, that's an interesting analysis. So I asked him a little bit what a recovering Catholic was like. He told me about this, and he said, I said, well, you know, you're interested in spirituality. Tell me about your spirituality. Oh, he said, man, he said, I have found drumming. He said, and we go up once a month. He said, I go on Sunday morning, and he said, we go out to this place, a bunch of guys outside of Denver, and he said, we strip down to virtually nothing and sometimes into nothing. And he said, we march around and we drum. And he said, it's a phenomenal spiritual experience. And I said, what does your wife think about this? Oh, she loves it because I'm a different man when I come home because I'm changed so much. He said, hey, Gary, you're interested in contemporary spirituality. Why don't you come with us next summer, Sunday? And I thought, that would be an interesting experience. And I guess I even debated about it for a little while, but you know, my idea of an exciting spirituality experience is not walking around a room with a bunch of naked men banging on drums. Some of you may get turned on by that, but not by me. But how does this all combine to apply to where we are now? How does it apply to contemporary spirituality in 1999? Well, look around you. Some people, I suspect, will think, yeah, ho-hum. They'll be bored by the whole idea and say, okay, I've got to do 15 chapels this year and I'm almost through this one. I'm not much interested in this stuff. Other people probably look at all this stuff and you kind of shake your heads in amazement and say, how can rational, logical people believe that they blow up parts of Jerusalem? I read someplace yesterday, the Jerusalem government, has allocated $12 million this year just to protect the sites around Jerusalem from extremists that they're worried about. It's not about reading something on the plane. Other people will not so much be bored or shake their heads, they'll just laugh at the stupidity of the whole thing. But then there are those who come up and they go on the condemnation route. And they write books, and they preach, and they get on the radio, and they talk about these weak-minded people who have all these crazy ideas. Some of you might even feel a lot of sympathy with these people. You might be searching, disillusioned yourself, maybe uncomfortable with the church, aware that something is missing, going through the motions of Christianity, but not really expecting that a psychologist coming to give the Wesley lecture is going to really try to understand or have any sympathy for you. But I see the contemporary spirituality movement and all this stuff in another way. I see it as an expression of the fact that we live in a society where people are searching. They're in a soul search. In one sense, I'm kind of with them because I want a spiritual maturity. I want a connection with God. I want a sense of security in these changing times. But like Wesley and like a lot of people in this room, I'm going about my spirituality in a different way. I want my spirituality to be tied to a relationship with a person, somebody who knows me intimately, somebody who accepts me, somebody who loves me and sticks with me and forgives me and communicates with me and knows all about my weaknesses and some of my immaturities, but still hangs in there with me. And somebody who helps me deal with suffering and understand the issue of suffering as best I can and help me find meaning in my life and keeps me from anxiety when so many people around me are worried and uptight about a lot of stuff. I want a unique kind of God that I never encountered in any of the stuff I read on the new spiritualities many centuries ago. The Apostle Paul was in Athens. He was very much interested in the spirituality of the people there. We read about it in Acts chapter 17. Paul's waiting for some friends to come, and he doesn't go out to his room and kind of hide and read a book. But while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, on verse 16, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. And a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him, and some said, what is this babbler trying to say? And others remarked he seems to be advocating some foreign gods, and they said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." Then this next verse, see if this sounds contemporary. "And all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the new latest ideas." So Paul gets up and he gives a speech. I go back to that because I like Paul's example there. See, first we see Paul was interacted with the culture. He didn't pull apart and laugh at them or condemn them. He interacted with the culture. He looked around. He saw the gods they worshiped. He looked at the religious leaders. He spent time with them. He was aware of what was happening. Secondly, I noticed that Paul respected the culture. He didn't agree with them. He didn't hide his own beliefs, but he at least gave them a respect. He didn't condemn them. He didn't drive them away. I noticed something else about Paul. He earned a hearing in the culture because he spent time with them, respecting them, finding out what they thought. He was invited to speak. And he got up and he spoke because he'd earned the hearing. And when he got up, his speech is really interesting. It's interesting. It's there in the 17th chapter of Acts. He gets up and he says, "I notice you've got an unknown God." He talks about that. He says, I see who you are. I see what you believe in. He even quotes their poetry. If he was here today, he might be quoting MTV and something about the videos they're watching. He'd know the movies that are popular. He would know that the 20, 30 generations, if you want to understand people, if a guy like me wants to understand people like you, I got to know about your movies because you're shaped by your culture. You're shaped by the pop culture in which you've been steeped more than, say, my culture was. And then Paul goes on and talks about the uniqueness of God, and he doesn't hide that, but he earns the hearing. Then he gets a mixed reaction, because if you read in verse 32, you see that some people sneered and some people wanted more, but some people believed. Now, how do we put all this together with all this stuff that's going on in our culture and where we are and what Paul did in his culture, and how does it apply to us right now down to where we are? Well, let me make just three suggestions. Let me suggest to you, or let me remind you, that the new spiritualities we see out there, including the end time panic, the new spiritualities represent a searching. The people that we have in our culture are not people who need to be condemned so much as they need to be shown compassion. These are people who more than anything else want somebody that will contact them and relate to them and build relationships with them. And they're interested in people who have something they really believe in. Somebody who will even say they know Christ. They don't need Christians to get in their little holy huddles and not ever talk to anybody in the world. They don't need people out taking shots at postmodernism and the cultists and the New Age spiritualities. The same people who never reach out and never try to understand and never be willing to let people see Jesus in us. I'm not preaching at you. I'm preaching more at myself. Because I find myself with groups like this. A lot of my friends, most of my friends are Christians. Most of my acquaintances are Christians. And if I withdraw from the world around me, how do I have any impact with the world around me? And how do I learn what's going on when I'm surrounded by a whole generation of people who are searching? So remember, that all these things that are going on reflect, it seems to me, a searching. Secondly, let me suggest that you try to find ways to reach out. Sometimes I think we just stand back and say, "God, I don't know how it's going to work. But somehow, will you use me to impact soul searchers in some way where I am with my gifts and my abilities?" A couple years ago, I was speaking at a conference of psychologists. We're all Christian psychologists. But there's one guy came up to me at the conference, and he said, I'm working on a PhD. And I'm going to be a clinical psychologist when I get done, if my field exists at the time. He was aware of a lot of changes in the field. And you know, and I thought a lot about this guy after the conference was over. And he put it on my mind several times. And 2 or 3 years later, just recently, I met the guy again. He said, I want to introduce myself. I met you at a conference a couple of years ago. And I said, "You're the guy." And this was in a crowded hallway at a conference about maybe 6 months ago. And we talked for 10 minutes, and I just interacted with this guy, and he was gone. I got home, and there's a long email from this guy. It's probably 2 pages in length. And he said, "Gary, I got to tell you something. I didn't want to come to the conference you had. I didn't have the money. And I want to tell you, I've been doing my stuff at the university, and my Christianity's got pretty dead. And I thought, if I come to your conference, somebody's going to criticize me, or somebody's going to put a guilt trip on me, or I'm going to hear somebody getting up and they're going to preach at me, and I didn't want to come. But I decided to come anyhow, and I got in my car, and I was driving, and I said, okay, Lord, I don't want to go to this thing, but could you just have somebody speak to me or get to me somehow at that conference?" And he said, "Gary, you were the person. You were the guy. You were Jesus to me." I was stunned when I read this. I'm not telling you this like it happens. I get these emails every day. It's the only one I ever got in my whole life. But see, God apparently used me to touch him at a time when he was struggling, like he uses you to touch people around you in the most unlikely ways when they are searching and when they are struggling. I knew nothing about what was going on in this guy's life. We have the challenge, the opportunity to be God's instruments to reach the people around us who are struggling. So ask God to help you. Try to find a way to reach out. Not do anything dramatic, but what's he going to do through you? So let me suggest that you try to understand these people as searchers and try to reach out to them. And then last thing, take a look at yourself. In this age that's obsessed with spirituality issues, where are you? How relevant is your faith? How do you respond to all the contemporary spiritualities around and the panic that a few people have? How confident are you, like Paul, that you've got something to hang on to, to give you strength, to give you direction, to give you security, to give you a place to be in the new century? We're living in some exciting times. I think really exciting times. In the midst of a lot of new contemporary spiritualities. But I think that in the midst of all this, we need to understand what's going on and then pull back and sit back and think, well, where am I in all of this? That's what I hope we'll talk about tomorrow. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you put us where you put us, in the time that you put us, you put us, and have given us the abilities and gifts and even the weaknesses, and you made it, let us be your servants. Somehow let us be Jesus to somebody else around us. Thanks for bringing us together for this chapel time together. Guide our thinking, we pray, as we go through this day and this week and this quarter. Thanks that we can acknowledge that you're a God who hears us and is concerned about us. We praise you, thank you for our time together, and pray with anticipation in Jesus' name. Amen. See you tomorrow.